I think you should go hard on this. So you have 100,000 listeners a month. You're making single digit thousands of dollars. You would make like six figures a year for sure doing this. All right, good. So, Sean, what's good? What's going on?
What's up? What's up? You got Ben still on the line. What do you got for Ben? Normally, you're like, turn off your video. We need to focus.
I'm going to tell you why. So, Ben made a comment to me, maybe to you too. I think you were here like a while ago, a month or 2 months ago. And I've been thinking a lot about it. And he kind of made it not a big deal, but it's kind of a big deal to me. So, Ben, I haven't told you I'm going to bring this up. I'm only going to like kind of mention the thing, and then you could kind of explain it how you want to. But basically, Ben Wilson has this podcast called How to Take Over the World, and you said that a very wealthy person, like a hundreds of millions of dollars person, has you on retainer and basically tells you the strategy that this person's going to do in business. And you tell him stories from history to let him know what you predict will happen. Is that right?
What?
Yes. Yes. Is that crazy?
What?
He didn't explain it that way, but that's exactly what happened.
It's like a sugar daddy, but it's like a history daddy. You're like a history baby, I guess. Sugar baby.
Okay.
That's so true. Did I explain that?
Yeah. So here's the full story. I get a lot of people who reach out to me at this point, basically any fan who's like, hey, can I talk to you for a little bit? I'm just like, yeah, I'm not that big yet. If you're big enough that you want to, if you think I'm important enough that you want to talk to me, yeah, I'll talk to you. That's starting to change a little bit. A lot of people want my time now, but this was a while ago. And so I said, yes, I'll talk to you. He's like, I'm thinking of starting something. I want to talk to you about it. I was like, okay, this guy's probably a joker, but whatever. He reached out to me. I'll talk to him. So we hop on a Zoom, and first thing, like, he's got a glass wall behind him, and you can tell he's in like a very, very, very high rise in New York City. You can see the whole skyline behind him. So immediately I was like, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And so he was like, yeah, I'm a managing director at XYZ Bank, one of the biggest banks in the world. And I lead their X division, very, very big financial division at this big bank. And he's like, I just randomly found your podcast and you don't know this, but I've been listening to you. You're my guru now. So I want to talk to you about like what I'm thinking of starting. And I just want to bounce it off you and see what you think about it. And so he gets to call me whenever he wants
sounds more normal. Sam was saying he specifically wants you to tell him based on history, here's what's gonna happen. Is that
you said that like I said, I explained it differently, but that's what's going on here. Like, he likes you and he wants you to like tell him like, how would Julius Caesar handle this, or how did Julius Caesar handle this? Tell me like what to do.
That's basically the angle he's going for. Yeah, because he knows me from How to Take Over the World. So, yeah.
Oh, my God. That is amazing.
Isn't that awesome?
Well, first of all, hopefully me laughing about it doesn't blow this for you. But wow, that is amazing.
But listen, I want to ask you more questions about this, Ben. But I had the same reaction, Sean. I was like,
what?
That sounds like a scam. But I've been thinking a lot about this, and I actually think that's a great idea. I think that is a wonderful idea. What do they say? History may not repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes. If you can just tell people what behaviors to avoid, or like how other people have had the same move and what happened, I think that's great. How much is he paying you?
Zero.
What?
Zero.
I thought he was paying you. I thought you were like on retainer.
No. He's paying these. So he offered to pay me, and I said,
how much did he offer? How much did he offer?
Well, he didn't offer explicitly, but he said
people,
he said people who do what you do, who consult people like me, often make upwards of $5,000 an hour. I don't think he would pay me that, because I've never done it before. I'm not like a high level coach, but I was like, well, that's a pay range I was not considering, I must admit. But he said, I will pay you. But then I ended up telling him, no, don't worry about it. And I just think it's better to have the connection and have him think that he owes me at this point.
Okay, that's fine. I actually think that there's like is something interesting here, like because like Alex Friedman or like these like thinker type folks, like they definitely could get paid $5 or $10,000 an hour.
All right, a quick message from our sponsor, which is of course HubSpot. Now look, growing a business is tough, and it's tough because a lot of times you have to duct tape a ton of software together to make it work. I've been there, and it's a pain in the butt. You have this thing connecting to that thing, and the two things that are being connected, one of them breaks, or the thing connecting them doesn't work, and it's a mess. You have all these moving parts, and it's just a pain in the butt because you don't know where the single source of truth is. And that's where HubSpot's customer platform comes into play. Finally, you've got this single source of truth where everything is organized and tracked in one place. For example, if you have customers emailing you, they've got really easy ways to see who on your team is replying to which customer, what they're saying, and things like that. And you can track it all in one place. They also have a lot of AI-supported stuff, which means that you can automatically know which type of messaging you need to send to that type of customer. And yes, it sounds natural, like a real person. I actually use it. I use it with my company, Hampton, and it works wonderfully. And when leads come in, you know which channel they came through, you know who's going to follow up with them, and it's all seamless and easy. So if you're interested, it's simple. Go to HubSpot.com and check it out and see how you can use it to grow your business.
Yeah, but this to me is more like the way you described it, it's more like, you know, in Billions or whatever, it's like the guy's got a kink and he goes to like get dominated by some chick in a mask with a whip. To me, it's more like that, where it's like some rich guy's just like, hey, I need you to, when I call you, I need you to tell me that I'm a huge fuck up and I suck. And that's going to motivate me to go into this meeting and prove myself daily. And I will pay you $2,000 an hour if you are a hot woman who tells me, I suck and you spit on the webcam. To me, that's more where the opportunity is than like telling me about lessons from history.
No, this is good because it's like, let's say that he's like, I'm working on this thing. My opinion of it is this, this, and this. And Ben goes, well, you know, Rothschild, the reason why they did really well because they just got information just a little bit faster and they did this, yeah, this,
but dude,
this, and this.
The business is so context dependent. It's not like you actually need the strategies of the Rothschilds or Julius Caesar. I don't think. I think it's motivational to hear these stories, right? Like I use one story a lot.
But why does it matter if it's motivational or if it's like, strategically,
well, that's kind
actually
of,
accurate.
Well, because you got to know, what am I delivering, right? What am I actually selling this person? Am I selling them strategies from the 1830s? Or am I selling them that, hey, you know, for example, Ben, I use this anecdote you have from How to Take Over the World, where you talked about, Edison used to be like, he was amazing. He was like, had done so much by the age of 25. And he's like, but Nikola Tesla had already done XYZ by this age. I'm so behind. And even though he was the greatest inventor of our age, he personally felt behind because he was comparing himself to someone. And then he read that Julius Caesar used to go look at a statue of Alexander the Great and be like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? Alexander the Great already ruled, you know, the world by now. And to me, that lesson was like, you know, that was actually a pretty important lesson. A lot of people feel like they're behind or feel like they compare themselves to others who are doing better. It's like, dude, there's no end to that. Julius Caesar used to do that and feel that way. So you know that's a trap. You know that there is no amount where you'll stop feeling that way. So might as well just let it all go.
But that's kind of the same thing. You're just talking about life strategy. Yeah, I agree with you.
I'll tell you how it actually went, because what you said, Sean, actually plays into it. That he said, I'm thinking about starting this thing. It's a higher possible outcome, but if I stay where I am right now, it's just a more steady, like I can go from whatever, I can go from 220 to 500 hopefully in the next 10 years, but I'm not going to become a billionaire essentially, but if I go start my own thing, I could lose a lot of money.
What does 220 mean?
220 million.
Oh, that's what he's worth.
No, I am saying number. I'm not going to tell you what he's worth, but it is in the hundreds of millions.
Sounded pretty specific to me. All right, go on. Sounded like not a made up number. All right, go ahead.
And so he was essentially like, should I do this thing? So I tell him, I talked about the concept of exactly what you're
Dude,
saying.
First
Sean,
of all,
of like
so much pressure on you to say something that's not fucking stupid. So 100%.
I was literally, as he was saying this, I was like, why the hell are you talking to me? Like it was so funny to me. But he loved the podcast. He thought I'd have something interesting to say. So I was like literally just grasping in my head. I'm panicking a little bit. I'm like, what am I going to say to this guy? And so I start talking before I even know what I'm going to say. I said, okay, Well, have you heard of loss aversion? And I brought up the idea of loss aversion, which I'm sure you
guys... Have you heard of that?
He hadn't heard of loss aversion. So I explained to him a little bit what loss aversion was.
Explain it for somebody who's listening who doesn't want to go look it
up. So a loss aversion is the idea that that you value not losing your money more than you value gaining money. So you put more emphasis on it. So I essentially said, you need to make loss aversion work for you. Essentially, if you believe that you're going to be successful, then you need to visualize that success and say to yourself and realize every day that you delay starting your new thing that's going to make you billions, you're losing millions of dollars because you're failing to act. And he was like, that was amazing. That's changed my whole perspective. He was blown away.
That's okay, why they paid you the really big good bucks, about myself. Ben.
Yeah.
Ben,
yeah.
I think that you're doing something that's like so common, which is, and I do it too. You, Sean does not do this. you are putting too low value on your,
Let me tell you how it ends. So, it was like a month later, I was in New York City. So I said, let's meet up. Let's get lunch. We went to a really nice restaurant and he bought me lunch, which was very nice. And then I was like, so when are you starting the thing? And he's like, well, I'm not actually doing it. And he like gave his reasons why he's not starting it yet. And I was like, okay, well, it sounded good when it came out of my mouth, but apparently my advice was not that valuable.
You just spit in his water, drink it.
Yeah, exactly. That's when you need to go dominatrix, dude. It's a yin and yang, good cop, bad cop sort of thing.
I think,
by the way,
I think that
the loss aversion thing, I think the numbers are 2-1, meaning you'd have to make $2 to feel the same as losing one. You'd have to make $2,000 to feel the same level of emotional hit as losing $1,000 would be. I don't know if that's bullshit, but I've read that. That's the ratio of like how much we value loss more than gain.
Sean, do you get asked to consult and like do this type of stuff?
I get asked. I never consult anymore, but I basically run a simple filter, which is, would I do this for free? That doesn't mean I'm going to do it for free. It's, would I do this for free? So for Ben, in Ben's case, Ben's like, oh, this sounds like a super interesting guy.
And he did do it for free.
I'm going to learn as much from this guy as he's going to learn from me, if not more. So, you know, I'm happy to do this with my time. So that's one thing. And then the second part is, dude, you get paid crazy money for doing this type of shit. Like, Sam, you do these GLG calls. Have you done any of these?
I used to. I think I was getting paid $1,000 an hour.
Yeah, exactly. I set my rate at the max that they let you do, which is now $2,000.
It's $2,000. That's what it was.
And dude, I'll get paid $2,000 to just do like a 40-minute call with some, like, first of all, it's kind of funny because they're like, it is this like weird underground dominatrix shit where it's like, I'm a hedge fund manager. I can't tell you the fund. I can't tell you what I'm looking at. I can't tell you my name. But it's a one-way transaction. It's like I'm the masseuse and they're laying face down. I can't see who they are. And then they're like, okay, say the word metaverse. And I'm like, metaverse. And then like, all right, tell me which stock's gonna go up because of the metaverse. I'm like, dude, I don't fucking know. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, but I could tell you, you know, here's some things I think about.
Well, whenever I do those things, I talk really slow.
Yeah, because you just need the hour to pass.
Yeah, I always talk really slow. And I'll be like, wait, hang on, let me get my headphones.
Yeah. the better way, I can't talk slow. It's like I'm too nervous. Like I said, with Ben, you feel a tremendous amount of pressure. It doesn't really matter how much money you have. When somebody's paying you something, I would never pay someone $2,000. For a phone call, even though I'm sure there's an economic case where it makes sense. It's just a big number to me to just pay for somebody to talk to me. I'm so not used to it that when I'm on the other side, I'm getting paid. I'm like, I need to deliver this guy like some insane insight that and I put this weird pressure that just is unachievable. But I'll be like, I'll say my point, and I really only have one point. And I'll be like, another way of thinking about it is, and I'll repackage the same idea with like some metaphor or some analogy just to fill airspace. Because like in reality, it's one idea that's worth it for them or not. And I don't have like 10 amazing ideas. I have one around one topic, you know, I don't have.
But that's why Ben's shtick is amazing, because Sean, well, you can only consult on your life experience and you can't live that interesting of a life all the time. And whereas Ben can just he can just read a book a week and he's going to have like, you know, 52 new ideas a year.
The thing that this guy was trying to sell me on was that I should come up and speak to his bank, And he's like, you could get paid like easy, like $50,000 a pop to come up and give these,
that's
these
speeches.
And
I do $10,000 for a Zoom at home to give a speech to somebody now. And
how many of those?
And now
do you
I'm
do?
Like, why am I not doubling my price? Like, if they're not saying no to paid. This, I need to basically the pricing strategy is if, unless half the people are saying no, you're priced way too low. And so right now everybody's saying yes. Why not price double that?
I did one recently. It was $25,000, but it was in person.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many of those Zooms a month? How many Zooms a month do you do?
Not even one a month. One every 2 months probably is the current.
That's pretty sick to me though.
Yeah, it's great. It's great money because there's this other thing, Ben. I don't know what the history or psychology will tell us about this, but there's extra joy in making money when you can assign what that money gets to go to, versus just generally making money and it's going to go into a general pot of a bank account. Versus like, oh, $10,000. Or if I'm like, oh, I do these two speeches this month, I'll go buy that car. Or I'll go get my wife this gift. And she's like, wow, that's great. This work you did was awesome. And I don't know what the name for that metaphor is, but I abuse the shit out of that.
Consumerism. Just consumerism.
So you guys can tell me if there's ever a moment, like the reason I'm not doing any of this stuff is I just feel fraudulent, like going up there and...
That's normal.
But yeah, maybe I just need to get over it. I don't know.
100% you need to get over it. Like the way you should think about things is most of your life, you're basically underpaid. You're underpaid and underappreciated. And, you know, the universe has this way of evening itself out where like, you know, Sam will make more money off of like some random investment he thought about for 5 minutes than he would have, you know, grinding some business that his apartment roommate finder business he did for 2 years or 3 years. And so like, you know, the inputs don't always match the outputs in life. And once you sort of acknowledge that, you accept that, that's like the first thing you have to acknowledge, which is like the level of difficulty for me is not what dictates the value for somebody else. So that's number one.
Yeah, the effort is not in proportion to the output.
It's irrelevant. All that matters is the output. The fact that you know input is a liability for you. It is a weird psychological liability. You would be better off not knowing how hard it was to say that one thing to that guy at that moment. The second thing is that Mr. Market will decide what it's worth. And like, you might get lucky once, you might get lucky twice, but if people consistently pay you for something, it's because that's what it's worth to them. If not being worth more, right? They need a positive ROI on that interaction. And so just let the market decide, and the market over time will balance itself out. Maybe one off. Yeah. That was just a fluke. But if it happens consistently enough, and you should just expect it to happen consistently, then it works.
I think you should lean into this hardcore. Because how much money are you making on ads for your podcast? Say the numbers. Can you say the number? Do you want to do it or no?
Yeah, because I have one sponsor right now. It's
Cold Plunge. Shout out.
Cold Plunge. Go to the coldplunge.com.
Sam is the one carrying that sponsorship.
Use code Ben Wilson for, I don't remember how much off, $150 off, something like that. I will say I'm making a four digits per month, low four digits.
Okay, so 1 to 5,000 a month.
Correct. By the way, also the hack when somebody says how many digits, just take the bottom three numbers of that range. So if I say I make seven figures, I'm saying 1 to 3 million. If Sam says we sold for eight figures, it's 10 to 30 million. If somebody's right, like nobody, if you're over half, you usually say it differently. If you cross over 50 million, you would say over 50 million, not eight figures.
Or like the figures can include the dot zero zero.
Yeah, there you go.
that's a figure. Nine figure exit, bro. So I think you should go and do this, Ben. I think that you should go hard on this. So you have 100,000 listeners a month. You're making single digit thousands of dollars. You would make like six figures a year for sure.
You should do your own ad read, which basically says, look,
yes,
you listen to this. And I, you know, people who listen to this tell me they got a bunch of inspiration. They got, you know, some strategies. They got, they filled in the gaps of something they didn't know about history, and they can see, you know, their place in the world today through that, whatever, blah, 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 some bullshit. And you basically say, you know, I used to run ads for, you know, cold plunges. By the way, use code Ben Wilson at checkout if you want. But, you know, actually what ended up happening, and you just basically say, this is what ended up happening. Company started hiring me to come in and talk to them about lessons from the greatest, you know, the greatest blah, blah, blah in history. And it's motivational for the executive team. It's a great addition to any offsite, blah, blah, blah. And so that actually ended up making me more money than the ads. So if you're interested in that, you should contact me, blah, blah, blah. I bet if you do that, you'll get one of these a month and it will quadruple your current ad, ad revenue for the month.
Dude, you got to do this, man. You got to do this.
Okay. Next month, we'll do another segment in Ben's First Million and see how it's
look,
going.
You can make it as simple. So my best friend, Neville Medora, he has this things that he calls consults. And if you go to his blog, like copywritingcourse.com/consult, there's just like a checkout page and it's $1,000 and you booked 1 hour with him. And you pay and then you just like select on Calendly. And then every like Tuesday and Thursday from like 9 a.m. to like 1, he just knows that he does call those. That's his call time. And he makes a lot of money from it a year. You could do it as simple as that.
The other thing, by the way, you need to do like a profile of how to take over the world of like, I think, you know, you've done jobs, but I think if you do like Pixar, right, and you say, you know, here's Pixar's kind of creativity process, how Pixar consistently has creative hits and, you know, storytelling or something like that, that opens the door for you to basically teach the Pixar way to a bunch of companies that want to be better creative, you know, more creative or storytellers or whatever, and replace Pixar with any company that's excellence in X category. And you just tell your story as you always do. And then that becomes part of your slightly more corporate repertoire that, you know, maybe they don't want to hear the Putin story, but they want to hear the Pixar one.
Yeah. So you select the people by who will listen to this and then pay me money to consult, right, or
work
talk
backwards from that.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Apple and give them the Putin speech. And then all of a sudden, Google employees start mysteriously dying.
I think this is good. I think that so right now you're slumming it because you've got a small business that you're just starting and it's going to take time to get going. This will just supercharge it a little bit, I think.
And by the way, I always, whenever I give advice, the way I explain it to people is, I'm going to say some things that make you feel uncomfortable, either because you personally would feel nervous saying the thing I just said to a customer or quoting that price to a customer. The second reason is your moral code says, well, that's not what I want to do with my content. I don't want to feature Pixar because I want to give talks about, you know, creativity and storytelling. Okay, cool. I'm just telling you, if you crank the commercialization like sellout knob to 12, here's what you could do. And then you could decide to dial that back to 9 or 8, whatever you feel comfortable with. And
I always say it differently. I say, do you want your future kids to have braces or not? Get to fucking work. Like, you ever been to an orthodontist, my friend? It's expensive. Get to work.
That's amazing. That's too good. All right, let's do some other topics. Thank you, Ben. I appreciate the...
Ben, good luck.
I do appreciate the advice. I really do. Thanks, guys.
That's amazing, right? That I was thinking about that for like about a week.
That's
now.
Hilarious. I had no idea that was going on. All right.
He mentioned it to us, but he didn't make a big deal out of it.
What do you want to talk
what
about?
What do you want to talk? Okay. I know what I want to talk about. Well, I don't know if this is interesting to you, but I've noticed that your angel investing is on a tear. Our friend Suli just said, whatever Sean, what did he say? Whatever Sean.
He tweeted out a joke. He was like, oh, I got this new brilliant investment strategy. Sean invests in something, and then he tells me about it 2 weeks to 2 months later, and then I pay 10x price for the same item for the same company.
Yeah, it was great.
Which is and he's like anecdote, like he was joking. Obviously, that's not great. He's like making fun of himself because that's literally what's happened in like I think 6 or 8 deals now, where I'll even tell him about it, but he just delays responding for a couple weeks, or I forget to tell him, and I tell him. Or he tells me about the company a few months later. I'm like, oh yeah, I invested in that. He's like, awesome. Can you make an intro? And I make the intro. But the price has gone up like dramatically because the company has more traction or more whatever. So that's what he was joking about.
So I put you on like an email list for my friends where I'm sending you everything. Are you getting those?
No, I didn't see anything.
I sent you 2 of them so far.
Okay, maybe I need to.
I'll forward it to them. One of them. I'll send it to you after this. But anyway, so I'm starting it off where I'm sending them to you. So you gotta hopefully if you find something that interests me, you'll send back.
Yeah.
But how are you getting such good shit?
I don't know. Like, dude, it's amazing. So I feel like there's, I think the easy answer is, oh, cool. I do this podcast. And because of this podcast, people come inbound, right? The bigger this podcast gets, the more people want you to invest. And there's this great thing my buddy Vishal taught me, which he goes, startups are the only asset class. Like, real estate doesn't work this way. Stock market, like in real estate, if you want to buy it, you go buy it. If you want stock, if you want to buy it, you go buy it. Startups are the only thing where even if you want in, you don't just get in. The security selects you. The asset selects you just as much as you're selecting the asset. And that one insight is pretty important. It basically means you need to build your brand and your like reputation so that people want you in deals. Because the best deals are all like kind of like super competitive to get into. And you want people to, when they're first thinking of an idea, to reach out to you because they know, oh, you know, like, for example, I did a great deal recently and it's so funny. You're going to hate this. It's going to piss you off so much. You've been talking about short-term rentals. Somebody came to me with a short-term rental startup idea because they thought I was you or something, or somebody was like, hey,
bro, why didn't you send that to me?
Well, by the way, the subject line that she reached out with was last one in. It was like, hey, I have the smallest bit of allocation left in this.
Mother, golly.
It's this company called Hostfully. You'll love it because it's literally exactly what you're doing. You should get in. I'll enter you. You will get in. But basically what they're doing is if you own a bunch of Airbnbs, which is kind of like a new market, it's basically like you're a property manager. So you're more than just renting out your home or one home. So you have multiple properties, but you're not a traditional property manager who owns a multifamily, you know, like a building of like 32 units. And so this is for people who run multiple Airbnbs, and it's just like, it makes your life way easier as the owner of that. And they have like a few million dollars in recurring revenue. The valuation was great. Founder was really impressive. So I was like, oh yeah, great. SaaS software for people who manage multiple vacation rentals. And then you're over here building short-term rental club, building this community, doing this thing, and I got the benefit because people thought I was you. That's one answer. The piss you off answer.
That's ridiculous. That is a piss me off answer. Whatever. It is what it is. Send me that.
I'll send you that one.
What's the company called? Hostfully. Can we talk about it?
Yeah, Hostfully.
Hostfully. Yeah. Well, then I can just email her. Do they have a bunch of VCs behind it or all angels?
I think this round's a lot of individuals. I'm not sure. It was like, I was kind of late to the party, so I was just pretty quick to just be like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. Once you have revenue in a few million dollars that's recurring, and they really haven't even like figured out what their marketing strategy is going to be yet, it's like, okay, that's a pretty good signal that this is going to work. And it's a pretty indispensable tool for a property owner. So I like that one. But I would say, okay, here's some of the things that have happened. One is when I share deals with you, you share deals with me. My buddy Julian Shapiro shares like some of the best deals. He's just very like consistent with it. Meaning like every week he's sending me some good shit. That's, I would say 40 to 50% of the portfolio is relationships with friends who themselves are experts, and specifically people who are experts in one niche. So it's like, we've been doing a bunch of like salesperson software, and it's because we like have a relationship with Craft Ventures, who it started by David Sachs. He's kind of like the enterprise SaaS guy. He built Yammer, sold it for $1 billion. His fund specifically just focuses on SaaS companies.
And so, what you talked to, so David sends you stuff?
David, not me particularly. So my partner, Ramin, who runs my fund, he basically has a good relationship with somebody at Craft. So for example, when they're seeing something good, they're just trading notes all the time. And so we're getting to get in on a lot of their deals. So
are they giving you the deal because they like Sean or they like Ramin?
In this case, it's Ramin because he has that relationship. He's catching up with that guy every 2 weeks, goes to get coffee or whatever it is. But then I do the same with my guys, right? So I do the same with the people in India or the people in Southeast Asia, because I'm like, I think that's where a lot of opportunity is. And that's where I have the right relationships. So we're sharing stuff just amongst that. So, and then the other thing is like themes. So for example, once I decide that a theme is correct, like worth betting on, what I learned from Suli actually is the level of aggression you need to have. Once you decide X is a good idea, you need to go invest in that company and then like the five other companies that are like adjacent to it. So for example, there's this trend of banking, of like neobanks, right?
Yeah.
So this started several years ago where people basically were like, look, banks are something everybody uses but has super low customer satisfaction scores. Like their apps sucked, their marketing sucked. So basically people were like, look, we can create like a digital first bank. And this started like Nubank is probably the best example of this. It's in Brazil. They're like, oh, look.
Yeah. And they're about to go public.
People are underbanked there. So they started a Nubank. A friend of mine was like led their investment. And now it's a $10 billion company. And it has like millions of customers in Brazil. And then the same thing happened in the UK with Revolut and Monzo, whatever. So this idea of neobanking, basically of can you make super slick, like slick app for customers, digitally market to go get customers. And basically you're building, you're actually not building the banking part. You usually go partner with like some bank like BBVA or something like that. Under the hood, it's BBVA. But the customer relationship is with a company that's really good at taking care of customers and building good user experiences. Anyway, so that's the short answer is like, okay, decide that that's a good idea. And that takes many forms. So like we talked about this before, like Ramp or Brex. These are like, Brex, I think, was the fastest growing YC company in the last few years. And you look at it, you say, is this a good idea? You say, well, what are they actually doing? They're basically giving credit cards to some group of people that were dissatisfied with current credit card providers. Brex did it for startups. And they get a portion of every time that card swipes. Oh, interesting. So if a million people are spending $1,000 a year on it, and they're keeping 1.3% of the interchange fee of the debit card or whatever, you can come up with some number. You say, wow, this company's going to get big pretty fast. So we did that math of neobanks, how much is a neobank customer worth and how much is a credit card customer worth? And then we went and did it in every niche we could think of. So we invested in Keep, which is doing this for Canada. And then we invested in Pluto, which is doing this in the Middle East.
But did you holler at them?
Yeah. Then we go search and destroy, basically. It's like, how do you go hunt for the best companies that are doing this in either this geography or with this customer base? So, for example.
And you just DM them on Twitter, probably.
Yeah, exactly. We just reach out, cold DM, and say, hey, I'm a believer in this for this, and this reason. What you're doing looks super interesting. Would love to invest. And sometimes it comes inbound. Sometimes it's, oh, you got 100 things inbound, but you know what you're looking for. So you quickly pounce on the four that fit your thing.
Aren't you out of money at this point from the fund though?
I raised more money. Cause I was like before I thought, dude, you know, will I get $1 million worth of deals every quarter that are good deals? I'm not just trying to invest in crap. So I need to invest in good deals. So I was like, I don't know how many high quality deals I'll have. And now, I realized that like whatever I had before was too low. So now we're doing almost 2 million a quarter. We raised more money because we just had better deals.
Man, I started angel investing almost 1 year ago. Well, I did it five or eight companies
personally,
in the last, yeah. Before that, I forget. And a couple of them have turned out to be like meaningful, like turning 20 grand into like $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. And I'm like, holy shit, yeah, this is how
awesome.
It works.
Yeah.
and like, but like it sucks for a while, right? Because you just invest it and you're like, well, that's money's gone and you don't ever hear about them. And then totally. You're like, oh, nice. It works. And so I'm like, and so some of those cases, those are huge markups. In other cases, I'm just now experiencing like 2 and 3 and 4X markups. And I'm like, that's awesome. What would happen if that was, had I invested in this company at a $10 million valuation instead of a $50 right. million dollar valuation, that would have been wild. And like, how do I do that?
Well, one of the reasons, so I hated startup investing for a while because I was like, you know, is this the best use of time and money?
Dude, it feels like an expensive hobby. I'm just spending money and not getting anything in return.
Yeah. And then I realized two things, which is Bezos has this quote, which I believe he goes, one of the biggest competitive advantages you can have is being long-term oriented. Basically, if you prioritize, if you have a 10-year view where you're like, okay, I'm going to maximize what I can do in 10 years. And the other guy's trying to make the most they can make, you know, for their quarterly earnings call, right? This is how Amazon worked, right? Amazon was basically like, we're willing to lose money to invest so that we provide 2-day shipping instead of 7-day shipping, or free 2-day shipping, or a larger selection, but it's going to cost us more because we're going to have more inventory or whatever. So we're going to go into all these other verticals, books, CDs, whatever. They basically said, like, his strategy was long-term, this is going to be the most valuable strategy. Short-term, we're going to get punished by the market because our quarterly earnings are not going to look great. But that turned out to be the, like, magic, you know, the sort of, like, the biggest competitive advantage Amazon had was their ability to be long-term oriented. I think this is true just in general, which is if you're competing against somebody who they need a result in 1 year, and you're willing to be patient and get the result in 5 years, 7 years, or 10 years, you can make bets that they can't make. So that means you get to have lower price bets, that will pay off bigger just over a longer time horizon. So I think if you have the luxury of a long-term time horizon, that's a competitive advantage. So that's how startup investing works, is if you need money or you need to see positive growth in 1 year, startup investing sucks. If you're willing to play a 10-year game, this can be an awesome game to play. And so
do you think that, you told me, you're like, man, I think I could 3.5x my fund because that's average. Now it seems like it's going to be significantly more.
Yeah. Like, you know, you think about kind of like what's the floor, you know, I think a 3.5x would be, you know, a solid outcome, but you know, nothing to write home about. But like with a small fund like ours, you know, you could see things where you can get a 15x, you can get a 20x. There are literally crypto small funds like ours that have had 100x, they 100x'd the fund in the period of time. Right. So, you know, you shouldn't really, the ceiling is high, but the floor is pretty reasonable. So the first thing was, okay, long-term oriented is a competitive advantage. I like startup investing for that reason. The second one is, you want to do things that compound. So for example, if I wanted to beat the market in the stock market, right? I want to beat the S&P 500. I need to have proprietary like intelligence. I need to be smarter than anybody else about something. And I think just being smarter at a game where money's on the line is just really hard to do. Whereas if you do, if you basically say, hey, my advantage comes from my reputation or my network of people that I know, that's just going to compound every year. The more deals I share with you, the more deals you're going to share with me, the more companies I have that are winners, that's going to make it easier for me to get into the next winner or for founders to come reach out to me because they'll say, oh, I saw you did these 5 Indian unicorns. I'm in India. I want to be the next one of them. So you should invest. Can you invest in me? So compounding also comes into play here in a way that doesn't happen in the stock market and doesn't even really happen in real estate. Real estate has it to an extent, but not in the same way as how fast your reputation can compound in startup investing. So anyways, those are my two reasons why I now actually view startup investing as a game worth playing, because it uses two of the superpowers that I believe in, that I think most people undervalue.
Is it gonna, what do you think will earn more, the e-com thing or this angel investing thing?
Probably for me personally, the e-com thing, because I just own the majority of that company. So, you know, if it sells for $50 million or $100 million, you know, I'll own the majority of it. But whereas with startup investing, you know, it's like my fund invests $100,000. We own 0.8% of this startup. I personally have 20% of the carry, but then I share with Ramin and Ben and Zach. Right. I personally own 14 point something percent of the carry or whatever.
Sure.
You know, so it's not like, you know, you're owning a slice of something big versus just owning the, you know how it is, owning the majority of something right. That sells for a decent chunk is just better financially.
It's so much better. And yeah, I think that whenever people raise money, I'm like, are you sure, man? You might be able to sell this for $50 million and you'll make more money than if you raise money and sell it for $500.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, but I have to operate that other business, whereas startup investing is like, you know, a joy, right? You just read about cool ideas, you meet awesome founders and you say, yes, you write the check and then they go do the hard work. So it's, you know, just a different thing.
So you brought up SDRs, short-term, they're called short-term rental SDRs. Have you researched that at all?
So I joined your club, but
fucking okay, crazy, right?
Tell
did
me
you,
two
like,
things.
Did you just review it?
Yeah, I've been looking at some of these posts.
And dude, did you see like, it's like techie guys. It's like people who have like $100 million companies.
By the way, I don't know how like you founder of Facebook, but like every time I open Facebook, whatever you're working on is always the top fucking post on my feed. I don't know if Facebook just knows that I love you, but like if it was trends was always at the top. That. If it's Sam talking about his cold plunge, it's Sam's video of his cold plunge naked at the top. Like, you know what hits in the Facebook algorithm in a way that like I don't understand.
I've always been like that. It's always been that way. For some reason, I mastered Facebook, and that sucks because it's the least valuable.
Dude, it's the most valuable. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
what do you want to master, Snapchat?
I can only have 5,000 friends on Facebook.
Yeah,
there's a max.
But your groups are big. Okay, so but tell me.
But that group is sick, right? How many people are in it? 1,000.
There's 1,000 people in this group, and people are basically posting, "Hey guys, here's the properties I own," and they show a bunch of cool photos. My strat, like for example, my family owned 5 big short-term rentals in Kissimmee, Florida, which is 5 miles from Disney World. So my strategy is basically Airbnb is near Disney World. I have a full-time job. I'm a PhD student. Blah blah blah, and then they're showing like these Disney themed rentals that they have, and then people go ask questions in the comments, and then everybody's got this like you know, you're doing your magic thing where everybody feels comfortable just telling you how much money they're making, and everyone's sharing a bunch of good info. So I think that's really cool. What I wanted to hear from you is, give me the top two most interesting stories that you've learned out of
this. I'm going to tell you. I've got to be a little subliminal about this. So in that group, there's 11 or 100 or 1,000 people. I met one person that's got $35 million in homes. He owns about 20 of them. And he's currently making about close to $1 million a month in profit.
And was this person wealthy before this? How do you get to the $35 million worth of real estate?
They were mildly wealthy. They were worth probably $15 million. They had a business that they sold. Yes, they were not poor.
Right.
And they invested a lot of it into short-term rentals. And now they have a staff of a couple people who are full-time. And his take is like 800 grand a month. And I met another guy who worked at a hedge fund, and his name's Richard. If you Google Richard, he has a story in there. And he eventually quit his hedge fund. Now he owns $50 million worth of short-term rentals. And the themes that I'm seeing are this. One, institutional capital has not come into short-term rentals a significant amount. Two, the numbers might be inflated because the economy is crushing. But I'm not entirely sure if that is totally the case, but definitely could be the case. Three, a couple years ago, people were just buying places without doing much math, and the math like worked out when they're making 25% returns, and it's crazy. Now it's a little bit more challenging, but it's still a lot of opportunity. And it's sick, man. Like I've been learning all about it. It's wild.
So of the things you've read in here, what seemed like the smartest, what I'll call small ball strategy? So throw out the guy who's had 15 million bucks and now has built this big thing. Who's done a small ball, start small, grow it, and maybe in some niche that's a cool story out of this? Or you don't have to say who, but what do they do?
Is $1 million considered small? So if you buy a property for $1 million, you're going to put down 150 grand for some of these guys.
Yeah, that's
a guy in there. Small. Yeah. If you go, are you in the group right now? Search the word coconut. There's a guy who bought a plot of land it was a coconut farm in Mexico, and he put four, I think, tiny homes, and he rents them for $150 a day in Mexico, and he did really nice landscaping, but not complicated stuff. It looks beautiful. Do you see it?
Is it a
something farm? Farms.
Yeah. Can I say the name or no? Safa Farms?
Yeah.
Safa Farms.
So click it.
So six cabins.
And he created this like.
So it says a tiny eco hotel / farm, six cabins, one house, an in-ground fire pit at a pool in Mexico. And it looks cool. It's basically like a bunch of wooden cabins that look like really small, you know, one person, two person kind of stays. And then like really cool outdoor area with hammocks and pools and, you know, common areas and places to go do yoga with like chickens running around you.
Is that wild? And he talked about it in the post. I don't think he spent a significant amount of money to set that up, but he just, it's minimalist-ish. It's kind of nice, but it's definitely minimalist, but it's lovely. And so that's a really cool thing I've seen. A guy like that. Like that is really interesting. And what they do is they go and stay there a couple weeks out of the year.
Dude, how cool is Airbnb that it created this opportunity for anybody to say, hey, look, if you can create an awesome experience for people, like a great place to stay, a unique place to stay, we will give you money. You will be able to make money just by creating this cool little farm and huts set up in Villa Corona, Mexico. And how sick is that? And then on the other side, it's like, hey, you want to travel? Here's the buffet of like dope experiences that's not just cookie cutter hotel that you can go stay at. Like how sick is Airbnb? That's just like respect.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And what I'm learning is, so basically the order of importance is when you're looking for, it's just like content. It's just like scrolling through YouTube. And so if you look at it through that lens, you can make a lot of money. For example, when you're buying a property, you go on Zillow and you look at their thumbnail pictures. And you're like, what catches my eye?
Right.
And then if you don't see anything there, you're like, all right, that nothing here. But like, ooh, they took a bad picture here. But if they changed the angle here and they made the light at sunset, this will look beautiful. And so you're basically shopping for thumbnails. Hmm. And and then the second thing that you're wanting to do is you're not shopping in any place in which you have to create demand. And so you use AirDNA and it shows you who has the highest booking rate. And then the third thing you do is you pick a very specific niche and you have one unique thing about the property. For example, you call it a zen thing because you got like a little pond in the front. Right. Or what I'm going to do is you call it like has a fancy gym or has a putt-putt course or has unique thing.
Right.
Like deck with view of sunset. And so you want that one unique thing, and that's the same thing. That's the same way how content works.
Yeah, because it lets you reimagine, okay, if this home was not for a family of four to live every day and go to the grocery store and come home, well, then maybe this little space, instead of a living room that's about, just two couches and a TV, it's like, maybe this is actually where companies are going to come for their retreats, and it's actually going to be different groups of 25 at a time, and they need a big sauna in one area, and then they need a pool area and a barbecue pit. That's like, I will overinvest on these things, and I don't need to have these daily utility functional things that a normal house would need.
Right. And it's just been so fascinating because I didn't realize how many like tech nerds are into this stuff. That group is so cool. It's so interesting. And anyway, we can move on, but it's just an interesting world that I'm falling into. So like, Rohan from Priceonomics, he basically, he didn't tell me this, but it appears as though Priceonomics is on the back burner and all of his time is on short-term rentals. And he owns like seven of them. It's badass, man. It's a super interesting market.
Yeah. I just want to give money to this group and just be like, hey, anybody who wants to like trick out their place in, whatever, or buy their next property, hey, I'll just finance it with you and share cash flow if you want to, you can have some preferred return. That's fine.
So that is the thing that's interesting to me. There's no such thing, or there aren't many funds. So like you and I have invested, I think you did as well, in like a BlackRock like investment fund that like buys like 500 Walgreens and they just make 5%. There should be one of those for short-term rentals, just because if you believe in that category, you can have a REIT or skin in the game somehow that's passive.
Right. Yeah, that's wild. Okay, let's do one other thing. Let's see. I got a couple. Let me give you. Let's do two quick ones. Okay. Tailgate guys, have you ever heard of this business?
No. Right,
so this came up at FarmCon. So I go to this dinner with this guy. He listens to the pod. And he was telling me, I was like, I was trying to make small talk at this dinner where I was like, okay, I hate normal small talk. Like, I'm not just going to, oh yeah, how's the conference going? Good. Yeah, good. How about you? Good, good. And I also don't know anything about farming. So like, it's not relevant to me. So, okay, I can ask them a bunch of questions.
Oh, you like corn too?
Yeah, exactly. I don't have much to add there. So
what's your favorite type of corn?
So as a bit of an icebreaker, I was like, first job, like, what was your first job? I asked, did you have a side hustle in college? And I went around the table. I was like, did you have a side? Because everybody was doing something different now and they're all established now. But did you, when you were in college, have a side hustle? And everybody had an interesting one. So this, I put that in my question bank of like, interesting. Fun little convo when you're in a kind of entrepreneurial group. So one guy tells a story. He goes, yeah, dude, I think he went to like Ole Miss or like one of the Alabama or like one of these like Southern football colleges. And he's like, I created a like tailgate in a box. It's like, what? He's basically like, yeah, like tailgating is huge before the football game. People go to the parking lot and they want to grill and drink and play beer pong and do all this stuff. And he's like, he's like, my family used to like to do it. So he's like, first, my family, it was so competitive. So you had to go wait like kind of overnight to get your spot. He's like, so they would send me, I'd have to go down to the Grove or something like that. And I'd have to wait in the parking lot and hold my family's spot. And then I started to be like, okay, cool. You got the spot. Well, like, well, you got to set up the tailgate for us. Like, come on, we need tables for beer pong and we need this and that. So he's like, okay, I'll get the stuff every week and I'll go do it. And he would create a good setup. And then that space next to him was like, hey dude, will you set ours up? And he's like, all right, give me like $200. I'll get you guys some stuff. And they're like, yeah, sure. And then the price goes up and he's like, oh man, I can basically charge each little tailgating square, like each little group of friends, $500 to just set up a cool tailgate spot for them, turnkey tailgating. And so he did this at his college and he's like, dude, I was making thousands and thousands of dollars every semester running this. And I was like,
I Googled tailgate guys. Did it get acquired?
So that was their competitor. So there was a nationwide version of this. He was doing this at small scale. That was his college side hustle just to make a little bit of money. He's like, yeah, tailgate guys tried to come in, but they couldn't break into our market. Like, we owned our market. And I was like, who's tailgate guys? He's like, oh, these guys basically took this idea and they started doing it nationwide. And I was like, that's really smart. He goes, yeah.
But how does it work? Do you have, like, you just hire college kids and you exactly. say, we'll give you $50 an hour for 3 hours on Saturday. We get 50, you get 50.
Exactly.
And then do the kids go to, like, Walmart and buy the stuff?
I think either you give them the supplies in bulk or they have to go grab it. And you tell them, hey, you need to get this table and these balls and this beer and this whatever.
And you use, like, a company credit card exactly. or something that has.
Exactly. And yeah. and so tailgate guy, and what they do, the key is they would partner with the school. They would say, hey, we'd like to be the exclusive tailgate provider for the school. And the school would give them the license. And so they had a monopoly. And I was like, what? Wow. And it's like, yeah, actually, this is pretty common that schools will basically pick one vendor or provider. They'll sell the license rights. Basically, they'll let you become the official, you know, North Carolina, you know, the Tar Heels
and
tailgate.
And they link to you and stuff.
And you call it Tar Heel Tailgate. And it's like their thing. And you pay them a fee or a revenue share of what's going on. But in exchange, you get a monopoly. You get to be the only provider of this shit. And it's like super viral, right? Because you're just like, everybody sees, wow, that setup looks not bootleg. What is that? Oh, they use tailgate guys or whatever. Okay, cool. We should use them next time. And so tailgate guys, apparently, like, I think they got bought out by private equity or something, but they were doing, like, I don't know, $30 to $50 million a year doing this.
What?
And I thought, what a great example of a college hustle that you then scale up. You say, all right, if this works at my college, it's going to work at every college. And every college that has a football program that has tailgating. And then we have this repeatable sales model of going to the university. And we tell them, hey, these other eight universities partner with us. We'd like to partner with you. You get extra income and we will provide a safe, convenient way for your fans to do this. I thought
that's pretty
wild.
This
is really cool
it?
Little niche business. And then I started thinking, what are the other ones? What are the other businesses that use the same sales tactic of basically partnering with the school and becoming the exclusive provider? So we had a little mini, because the guy listens to the podcast. So we had like a mini brainstorm session at dinner where he's like, dude, this is happening also with scooters. When like Bird and Lime came out in cities, companies decided, oh shoot, we should become the exclusive scooter provider on campus. Like, we'll go drop these scooters all everywhere. It'll be branded with the school. The school will get a rev share for every scooter ride that happens. And we get a captive market that nobody can compete with us in. And so this started happening with scooters. And I was like, oh, damn, what else could be done? Because scooters is cool because it's a new category, right? Tailgating worked because it was a new category. So you just have to think about, like, what's something today that they don't even really have a an option for? Like, they're not really, there isn't really like a market for it. You're creating the market.
What did he say?
Well, we were kind of brainstorming, you know, he's like, you know, one of the hard things is now schools have gotten slightly wise to it. They won't give the license up super easily, meaning like they want to make sure they get a fair shake. So once you come to them with the idea, they're like, great, hold on, 90-day proposal, request for proposal period where we're going to go like see who wants to offer this to us. Or we're going to go talk to five companies before we just say yes to you. But in the good old days, it used to be like, oh, they used to be like, sure, you know, you came to us, so you get the deal.
I've learned a little bit about selling to schools. So I you frozen?
No, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. I sent you this company. It's called Cura Cubby. It's kind of a bad name, Cura Cubby. Okay. But basically, it's I just sent it to you. Actually, I told Joe to send it to you. Do you see it?
No.
It'll be. And what they do is it's like the most boring thing ever. So basically, this guy, Steven, he had an autistic kid. His kid was diagnosed with autism and he goes, I don't feel like sending him to a normal school. I don't think they're going to do anything. So he started a school and he, like, 20 kids in the neighborhood went to the school and he was like, man, managing the school. So first of all, that's amazing. Second of all, he was like, managing the school is a pain in the ass.
Right.
And so he found another parent in, he lives in Oakland. So the other parents are like tech guys. And he found this guy who sent his kid to his school, and they decided to build this software together that basically makes it really easy to collect tuition payment and also pay your bills. So basically like a bill.com or and then plus a QuickBooks and then plus Eventbrite. So you can like check into after school programs and stuff like that. And they are crushing it. And it's just four guys and they got it up to like $2.4 million in recurring revenue. But he's telling me all about selling into